The Bad and the Beautiful.
Sure.
Vincent Minnelli with Kirk Douglas, Gloria
yeah.
Graham, Lana Turner,
yeah.
Barry Sullivan. Well, there's this very interesting scene in which Kirk Douglas's character, whose name is Jonathan Shields, hotshot producer,
right.
bit of a user, bit of a taker, but he explains to Lana Turner at one point that he has to be alone after a film has wrapped. Or no, after a film has had the premiere, he just needs to be alone because he has this terrible feeling of emptiness and loneliness, and he doesn't know where he's at, and he doesn't know where his life is at, and he just has to be alone. That's bullshit, of course. What that means is, I feel like
he's
being
banging one of the extras, and
that's
when
right.
Lana Turner comes over one night, she finds him there.
That's it.
Or her there.
And she's very much in love, and she wants to share her big moment, and it shatters her terribly. Anyway, just to, that's in a very elaborate analogy to how I feel after the Oscar year is over. After it concludes, I don't know where to go. I know that
is Neil there by any chance? Because I don't hear him.
Well, he, you know, that's funny, because Neil's on hold. That's what I can't figure out with my fucking phone. I don't know
Hopefully
how to undo it.
All this.
Huh?
Hopefully he heard all that.
I don't know if he did.
Can...
Oh, now it's ended. Now he's gone. All right, now. Ah, Jesus Christ, what does it have to fucking happen? Let me try him again, and I'll call him. Because he was a little, now someone's calling. Oh, my goodness.
There you go.
I don't even know how to do this now, because I have to hold and accept. Hello?
Jeffrey?
Yes. I'm sorry, you know what happened, Neil, is that you went on hold on my phone. This is a brand new iPhone 5, and Bill is on his line, and he's on hold. I don't know how to... Let me try and merge calls. Maybe that'll do it. There's a button called merge calls.
15 Pro, like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, okay, you see on your phone... Right now it says add on the bottom.
I did that. And what it did is that it put you on hold and had Bill engaged. I'll try it again.
Well, I like that as a theory. If Neil could just be on hold the whole show, I'm engaged.
Well, now you got us all, Jeffrey.
Okay. All right. Anyway, I was about to say that the whole industry, that my whole life as a writer, as a columnist, I don't know about you guys, but I always feel like I don't know where to go. It's kind of this feeling of like the dregs, you know, that are always released.
The day after Christmas.
Yeah. So day after Christmas. So the only thing that got me going, and I know that I'm not representing a majority view, but I was really delighted in a kind of a stupid way with Roadhouse. And I know that what that sounds like is that I'm saying it's a dumb movie. And I think it's got a real style thing going on.
I'll say it's a dumb movie. Do you want to set this up and start it now? Are you recording?
I am recording.
Okay. So we're actually doing the thing right now. It's not like we're just having, you're just schmoozing with us. You've actually started your podcast.
Yeah.
Or as David Mamet would say, this is the thing, we're doing the thing, that's the thing.
This is the thing, man. This is it.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll set it up, you know, as a separate thing later, you know. I mean, I'll just record it, but...
If you've just joined us, we're here with the Misfits. Okay. Or as we call it, Grumpy Old Men 3.
That's not a pleasant thought, but okay.
Well, you were just complaining about Oscar season ending, and you feel like you got a lump of coal on
yeah,
the day after
I don't,
Christmas.
Because it's you know, there's nothing, the only thing that it used to be back in the good old days when I was a honored and welcome and embraced Sundancer. I did that for 25 years, almost 25 years. And then they jettisoned me in 19, I think it was, because I wasn't woke enough. But I was having a lovely, that was such a great thing to kind of sustain my life in January, and have to worry about the quality of movies coming out in January.
I think we all remember where we were. Neil, where were you the day Jeffrey was denied the Sundance press pass? So, but you were saying you're excited about, in a way, Roadhouse.
Yeah.
Actually, Neil was at the premiere here in New York.
And what was
yeah,
that like, Neil? How was there?
It was Okay. Well, it was at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I don't know if you've ever been in that venue, but it's like a mini Carnegie Hall. It's a beautiful space. And it's a huge screen. And Jake Gyllenhaal came out and introduced the movie and introduced the audience, you know, a lot of the cast.
Yeah.
But Doug Liman, who directed it, did not, he was there, but he did not go on stage because he's really annoyed that the movie was not released theatrically. And the reason, as you probably know, why it wasn't released theatrically, because when he made the movie originally, he had a theatrical deal with MGM.
Right.
But then MGM got bought by Amazon, right. And Amazon, MGM no longer had any decision making in this process.
Yeah.
So Amazon said, no, we're going straight to Amazon. We're going straight to streaming. But this is the kind of movie, and I was talking to Roger Friedman about this, and we both agreed that, you know, if this was released theatrically, this would have made a ton of money. I mean, this is the kind of movie, you know, for the Fast and Furious crowd and anybody that just likes action, this should have had a theatrical release, and it would have made, like, a boatload of money. Pun intended, because most of the movie takes place on the water and boat chases. But it really would have made a lot of money, and I think it was a mistake by Amazon, even though it's probably, I think, McCuddy's, isn't it streaming number one now, like on...
Yeah, it's doing really well, but one salient point you left out is that the filmmakers, including Liman, who's boycotted it at South by Southwest, got an extra $25 million from Amazon to not have to go through prints and advertising, I assume, and release it directly to Prime subscribers. I guess that's a prestige move because they don't see it as an Oscar-worthy movie, or that doesn't need to be four-walled. But I think you're right, and I think there's a whole generation that doesn't even remember the 1989 Patrick Swayze version.
Oh my God! You're saying that 1980—that's such an astonishing idea.
Right. I mean, it's almost—it's 30. What is it? 35 years ago? I mean, yeah. I mean, if you're
males 18 to 24, never even heard of Patrick Swayze.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're 30 years old, you weren't around when that movie came out. But the movie did play 100 times a day on TNT for 5 years. The movie was always on. I mean, whatever you turned on TNT, there's Roadhouse again, you know? So, it was either that or Dirty Dancing, another Patrick Swayze movie.
Ben Gazzara Before the Stroke was always nice to see.
But, you know, it's...
I just want to say, fellas, just as an interjection here, that I flinch whenever I hear the words Fast and Furious. I was a fan of the very, very first film, which Rob Friedman, who directed it. And I thought that was a decent little movie. I was okay with that. And I have hated with a passion every Fast and Furious movie that has come out. What has there been, 9 of them, 10 of them? Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think I'll give one nod to, I think it was number 7 that did a really... For a Fast and Furious movie, I thought tasteful tribute to Paul Walker at the end.
Yeah,
after his death,
yeah.
I would not have expected that from that kind of a movie, but I thought they did a good job there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's 9 versions of the same film. If you like the first one, you should like all 9 of them.
No, the first one was original. The first one had a real kind of, it was actually felt like a movie. It was developed to some extent about with the character and whatnot. The robo, you know, the emptiness of that franchise became very, particularly when Justin Lin became the principal, you know, director of all those films. I think that guy is absolutely demonic. And I started out as a real fan of his when I first saw
My point was that there is a big market for action movies, and certainly internationally. I mean, you don't really have to... Although I found Jake Gyllenhaal to be amusing with his smugness, and, you know, I think one of the characters says the guy comes on like Mr. Rogers, and then he just beats the crap out of you, you know? Yeah, I mean, do you have insurance? Is there a hospital nearby?
I thought it was funny. It was different.
That was a nice modern update to the healthcare system, probably.
Right, and then he takes the guy to the hospital, he takes them all to the hospital, and he's like, okay, are you going to be all right? You know, So, you know,
by the way, because we love to interject and backpedal here, I think it was Rob Cohen that was...
Rob Cohen. I meant to say Rob Cohen.
First.
And by the way, nobody in the Fast and Furious who's beaten somebody up would ever take him to the hospital. Nobody would ever do the Mr. Rogers
type of thing.
No, he would drive him to the hospital through 12 buildings.
Well, you know, even in the beginning, when it first starts, and, you know, he's doing these fighting matches, and the guy who's like three times the size of Jake Gyllenhaal is like, no, I'm not fighting.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny, but even with an international audience, you know, they make a lot of films that are low on dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, they're great choreographed action scenes on the water, the fight scenes. You know, if you like this kind of stuff, you know, I think you'll be satisfied with this movie.
I called it the greatest piece of shit ever made, and I meant that as a compliment. I will say, I think they spent all the talent money on Gyllenhaal, because you don't know anyone else in this film, with one or two exceptions. The sheriff is a great actor who's underutilized in this particular film, and has been.
I think it's Joaquin Dalmeida. He was
Queen of the South.
Well, no, yeah. Connor, what's his name?
Connor McGregor is, but he's not really an actor. He's more of a stunt casting.
No, isn't he a WWE or a UFC?
Yeah. This is his first. He's been asked to be in a bunch of movies, and he's turned them all down, including some Marvel stuff. Hmm. And this is the first thing he's decided to do. And even he says, "I'm not an actor." Gyllenhaal spent a lot of time with me, learning how to be, you know, teaching me how to be an actor, and I spent a lot of time with him, showing him how to avoid getting killed, which almost did happen in one of those glass breaking scenes. Gyllenhaal was kind of badly hurt, but I think this is a great ride. I think it owes a lot to the original, and then it blazes its own way in a couple of. I mean, there's no Kelly Lynch in this. There's no real love interest in the same way that there was in the original one. But I think Neil.
Well, he hooks up with that girl.
I think Neil's right. I think it would have made a lot of money this weekend.
But he does. There is a romantic thing. He hooks up with the girl that's married to the sheriff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
that's the sheriff's daughter.
Yeah. I don't know why you guys are describing.
I meant daughter. I meant daughter, not wife. That's what I meant to say.
I think that Doug Liman and Gyllenhaal are sophisticated fellows, and they really did not make just a typical, lowbrow action movie. You guys are describing it in these terms. I think it's a much more sophisticated. It's got a sense of humor about itself, a sense of dry humor. It's, there's no real sincerity in any of it.
No shading in any of the bad guys. There's no, and all of the fight scenes are identical. I mean, they're just identical.
It's a war.
Somebody walks up to Gyllenhaal, talks to him for 30 seconds, way longer than anybody would ever talk to anybody who's about to get in a fight with them, and just have a fight.
You know what it is? It's a old Looney Tunes Merry Melody cartoon stretched out to 2 hours. That's what it is.
It was the first
one. No, that's actually, I agree with that, the Looney Tunes aspect. It really does have, particularly during the last third, when it becomes on a kind of aquatic Mad Max,
I mean,
or Road
Warrior. Bugs Bunny will wisecrack with you for like 20 seconds before he starts fucking you up, basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a cartoon, but it's a fun cartoon. It's an enjoyable ride. It's not Shakespearean theater.
Yeah.
It's a fun action movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do think, I did not see it on my television. I saw it on a huge screen in surround sound. And I think, you know, although we did on my television show, Talking Pictures with Neil Rosen, Perry Nemiroff, who works for Collider, said she watched it on her iPad and she thoroughly enjoyed it on that. So, you know, I don't have that experience. I have the experience of watching it on a big movie screen with an audience. So I don't know how it would play out.
I would really have liked to have watched this movie on a big screen with a lot of people who had had a couple of beers and having fun. That would be nice. I watched it entirely alone in my solitude in my living room and just watch it on the my 65 incher. So that's, you know,
well,
what
to your the point then, Neil, was
way.
Were people cheering? Was there like applause breaks and stuff in the audience, even though it was a premiere and they were being nice to the stars there? Was there a rowdy sense of having a good time?
I I don't think there was applause breaks during the movie, but when Gyllenhaal came on stage, and he got applause when he started introducing cast members that were in the audience.
Yeah, well, that makes
sense. It was applause. But the premiere party was kind of cool because also right next in that same Jazz for Lincoln Center space, they converted the whole party space into like a Florida Key.
Oh, that's cool.
Straw on top of the bar. And, you know, they gave all these like Roadhouse coasters and vintage matches and, you know,
And then did actors start fights with each other and start tearing the place apart?
No, but
that would have been
the whole
cool.
cast was there and it was pretty packed. And they really
By the way, Jeffrey, that room is the same room that since you brought up the Oscars at the top, that's the room where they telecast the Oscars for all the New York actors and voters that can't get to Los Angeles or don't want to go. And the screen there is almost as big as the Ziegfeld. It's gigantic.
It is. It really is. And they converted the party space. It kind of reminded me less of the bar and Roadhouse than it did, if you remember the Tom Cruise movie Cocktail. Just kind of the way it was one of these outdoor things with all the straw roof and all that kind of stuff. And all the bartenders were wearing the Hawaiian shirts. And they had a whole, you know, you could order anything you wanted to drink, but they had all these specialty kind of Florida Keys kind of
was
drinks.
Was Conor McGregor there?
Yeah. And there was no, like, roped-off VIP area. You can go anywhere you want, talk to anybody you want. And there was tons of food being passed around, and everybody was friendly. And
well, Neil Rosen can go wherever he wants and talk.
No, anybody could have gone anywhere they wanted in this thing. Anybody. There was no a security guard standing by his side, nothing like that. You could have access to anything.
I think a lot of bouncers would have been really funny.
Yeah, it was fun. No, it was a
nobody.
Fun movie, and it was a fun movie, and I got the joke.
All right, what else are you watching? What else do you like, Jeffrey?
Well, I've made a point of not going to Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I'm very proud of myself. I will never see that film because I completely got off the Ghostbusters boat after the 2016 all-female version, which I didn't hate. I said, that's it. I'm not going to
I hated that. I hated the female version.
Yeah, it was a little overproduced.
You know, the last...
And that was too bad because that was Paul Feig, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
And I did not. Right. I also did not see I was supposed to see the new Ghostbusters movie on the same night of the premiere of Roadhouse, and I chose Roadhouse because I figured, all right, one piece of garbage and another piece of garbage.
I also made a very proud point of not seeing Immaculate, the Sydney Sweeney film, which is. Did you either of you guys catch that or?
Yes, no. I did catch that. I did catch Immaculate. And I got to tell you, again, we go back to Carrie Nemiroff, who she made us do that on the TV show. She loves horror films, and she loved this film. You know, Sydney Sweeney is you know, she's like the it girl of the moment, you know. But there's nothing sexy about that performance, I'll tell you that. I mean, in a nutshell, she's in this convent, and it's apparently an immaculate conception. And
what is? What's an immaculate conception? What is?
She's pregnant, I assume, is
okay.
What you mean.
All right. Okay.
She gets pregnant without having had sex with anybody. Apparently, God made her pregnant, you know?
Okay.
Why did you choose me? She goes, why? Of all the millions of women in the world, why did God choose me?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's very slow for two-thirds of the movie, or at least 60% of the movie. And then it starts embracing its B-moviness towards the last 45 minutes of it. And then it gets more... I'm more involved in it, and I'm having more fun with it because it's kind of crappy, and it embraces that towards the end of the third act. But the first two acts are kind of very slow and dreary, and, you know... But by the third act, kind of like, all right, we know we're a piece of crap. And
yeah.
Well, let me ask you both a question. Is Sydney Sweeney a movie star, or is she just a Euphoria, White Lotus television streaming star?
She's not a movie star. She does not have it. I don't care what you say, and I've talked to many people younger than myself who think she's really great because they love her chest. That's it. That's it.
But not in this movie. In this movie, she's just like, she's a nun all in her habit. And, you know, you don't look at Sydney Sweeney in this and go like, yeah, hubba hubba, to use a 1930s expression.
Well, she was kind of de-glammed in that Reality. Wasn't it just called Reality?
Yes, that was actually a half-decent film, by the way. That was probably the best thing I've ever seen.
Which is basically just she in a room with two other guys for 2 hours.
Because it was based on actual transcripts.
Well, that's a great word, McCuddy. De-glammed. She's completely de-glammed in this particular movie.
In this also, in Immaculate. Okay.
Yeah, you would not look at Sydney Sweeney. If you never saw Sydney Sweeney and saw this movie, you would not go like, wow, this girl's really like something. Yes, she's completely, like, the chest is not highlighted. Nothing is...
Did you guys see her host Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, I did.
Yes,
she
I did.
She was not de-glamorized. She was definitely glamorized in that one.
Mm-hmm. She also had a lot of different looks. I mean, I was sort of impressed that she, on one note, could make it look, the one note look different.
I thought she was kind of funny. Where she was working in a Hooters or something like that, if I remember correctly. And
yeah.
Nobody was getting tips, and they were just, he was just staring at their chest, and they're like, she's screwing up the order, but it didn't matter. Well, he has a $50 tip anyway, and the other people are doing the job diligently, and they're like, get out of here.
No, she was getting like $40,000. People were coming in and giving her all kinds of dough.
Yeah, but that was completely about her looks. But
it's not her looks, fellas. It's not, she, you know, there's a certain quality that women who are exceptionally attractive, they exude something. It's partly their eyes. It's partly the way they breathe. It's their vibe. It's their insinuations. They have the lull of their voice. All sorts of things contribute to, like, wow, she's really something. I don't think she has anything other than the obvious two, you know. And that's it.
Well, let me tell you about two movies that I saw that I highly recommend.
Yeah.
Okay. One is called Knox Goes Away, and it is
Michael
directed
Keaton.
By
yeah.
and starring Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
And he's a contract killer who's got like two doctorate degrees, and he decided to go into contract killing. And he's got he's diagnosed with this fast
deterioration of his mental abilities.
He has dementia,
right?
But it's like a 6-week dementia. Like, he's going from total lucidity to like completely not knowing who he is in 6 weeks. And he has to, and I'm not giving anything away because this is the beginning of the movie. His son, played by James Marsden, murders her. James Marsden's daughter gets knocked up by one of these white nationalist, neo-Nazi people. Mm-hmm. And James Marsden kills this guy, you know, because he's completely fucked up. And he goes to his father as a contract killer, and they haven't talked to each other in, like, 20 years. And he goes, you got to help me.
You got to take the rap for this, Dad.
And Keaton's got to help him and figure this out before he loses literally loses his mind, you know, and he has like 6 weeks to do it. And there's a lot of twists and turns, and Marcia Gay Harden's in it, and Al Pacino is in it. He plays Michael
Keaton.
Yeah,
but they
boss.
Both have very small parts, right?
Mm.
Yes, but they're in the movie, and I don't know if it's streaming or strictly in theaters. They sent me a link to it, but it's Keaton is the whole thing. I mean, he's what keeps you there. There's some nice twists, but it's really Keaton's show. And I love Michael Keaton anyway. I mean, I love that one, The Founder, when he played Ray Kroc for McDonald's. I mean, he's very good. And he's very good in this, and I recommend this.
I just tried to see it, actually, a couple days ago. I couldn't find it either. I thought, well, if it's not streaming, then it certainly is in some obscure, you know, theater in Manhattan. I couldn't find it anywhere. I don't know where it is, but it must be somewhere.
I don't know.
It's only just
somewhere,
you know.
Well, the other movie that I recommend highly, that Bill McCuddy has also seen, is the new Woody Allen movie called Coup de Chasse. McCuddy saw it before I did. I saw it last week, and I love this movie. And you know, before I tell you what this movie's about, I'm going to say that here's the thing about Woody Allen. Never count this guy out to make a great movie. I mean, really. I mean, there was this period I would say in the early 2000s, when he was making a bunch of media, early 90s, he made a string of mediocre movies, and I thought the guy was like kind of done. And then he comes back with Bullets Over Broadway and Mighty Aphrodite and Deconstructing Carrie.
Yeah.
Then there's another period of really bad movies.
Mm-hmm.
Then he, and I go, all right, he's old, he's finished. And then like in 2011 and 2013, he's back with Midnight in Paris and Blue Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's 87. And he made a bunch of shitty movies like Rainy Day in New York and Rifkin's, what was it called? Rifkin's
Rifkin's Festival. The one that was shot in San Sebastian.
Yeah, mediocre, crappy Woody Allen.
And you left out Match Point, which is what Coup de Chance is the most like, I think.
Well, it's a trilogy. It's like Crimes and Misdemeanors, Match Point, and now Coup de Chance. It's like the murder mystery kind of thing. And
a basic marital triangle about infidelity on the part of the young wife and her hotshot.
Well, it's about... First of all, it's in French. It's filmed in Paris. It's completely in French with English subtitles. If you didn't know this was a Woody Allen movie, other than the credit sequence in the beginning where it's the black background with the white same font, although he did play music over it this time. Usually, it's just nothing. He actually played, and he updates the music. It's not that 1920s stuff. He actually played like hip jazz music in this stuff. So, but you would really think this is a European movie. It's not this Jewish neurotic Woody Allen character where he usually has somebody play that. It utilizes French actors. The woman who plays the mother-in-law in the movie, she's a very famous actress in France. I think she won several César awards.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about, it's about a married couple, and the woman has an affair. And the husband finds out and decides to do something about it. Let's just put it to you that way. And
can I finish it, please?
It's not a podcast.
What happened? Something's going on. Hello.
Oh God.
I don't know. I think Jeffrey's pizza just arrived. I will say that I love this movie as well. I don't love it as much as Match Point.
What's going on?
I don't know. He's got another phone call.
I'm sorry. I was just told a woman. I'm at the Wilton Public Library, and the woman just came in and pointed at her wrist and her wristwatch and said, "You can't be podcasting in here," which I've done several times. And she just says, "You can only be here 15 minutes." Oh God! You know, it's just fucking life. You know, there's always some
shit
like that.
Did he take care? Did he solve the problem?
This is perfect. We can't script this. This is gold.
Well, there's nobody waiting outside. If somebody had reserved it or something, or they were looking. But anyway, I should have gone home, I guess. Anyway, the long and the short is, I just wanted to say that I think that the Woody is very intriguing because it's one of the few films of this type, which is, you know, what's going to happen next. It's very plot-driven. There's not a lot of personality in the main characters. You know, there's the boyfriend from her past. There's the infidel wife. There's the testy, aggressive husband who smells something. He senses something is up. But I'll tell you, I couldn't figure and I couldn't foresee what was happening. I could not predict the way it was going to, you know, unfold.
I'm not giving anything away, but the ending is great. I mean, the last, like, minute and a half, 2 minutes of this movie, it's just a great ending.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's all pretty great. I don't think it's as good as Match Point, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It wouldn't be in my top 10, but...
it would be in mine, and I think if you did not know this was a Woody Allen movie, as I said, you just walked into this.
Yeah.
It's you would not. I mean, it's like it's watching a French film. I mean, I think it's great. And by the way,
well, the world does know it's a Woody Allen movie, Neil, and that's why it's not getting wide distribution and why it got picked up and why it's been. I've saw it the way a lot of people did in some basement in Manhattan, and it's just not. It's not getting the reception it deserves for the kind of movie that it is. As long as you're the kind of person that can like Roman Polanski or whoever else you like that's in trouble right now, P. Diddy, as long as you can take the artist away from the work, I thoroughly enjoy this movie.
Steve, that's the only way to watch a piece of art, be it including films. It's just a certain box. You watch the film in that box. If you want to talk about the person that they are outside of their movie making expertise, that's a different conversation. I just don't think that there's any mileage in saying, well, it might be a good film, but I don't want to watch it. In fact, I condemn it because I don't agree with the character or the history of the filmmaker. That's just one of the lamest ways.
Well, regular readers of your column know this is where you stand. I mean, I wish it would get...
Well, why don't you say what you think? I'm trying to...
I've said it. I think it's a great film. I don't think it's quite as good as Match Point. And I wish that more people would be able to see it. It's going to come out in theaters eventually in the United States.
No, it will be. It's already. It's not like a top theater, but it has a run date at I think it's Cinema Village or something.
That's right. It's a double feature with Michael Keaton's Unfindable film.
Do you think it means something, by the way, culturally, that for a while there, Woody Allen's films couldn't be seen anywhere. They weren't even streamed
initially. Well, that was Amazon, Jeffrey, and that was Amazon's decision. This is no longer an Amazon. This is not an Amazon film. I don't know the name of the distributor, but this distributor decided to release the film theatrically, whether or not movie theaters decide, or movie chains. I mean, it's playing at Cinema Village. It's not playing at... Lowe's, whatever. But Amazon just buried the last two movies. But this is by the way, the woman...
But the last two movies were trying to be Woody, and this isn't trying to be Woody. I think people are doubly offended by the old guy that has the young girlfriend, like every Woody Allen movie that isn't one of his serious ones. And I think this one deserves a chance because it doesn't have somebody parroting...
But it's also all that, as I said, all that neurotic Woody Allen shtick is not here. And usually...
Yeah. Well, that goes back to your point of view. You didn't know it was a Woody Allen film.
Whether it's Jesse Eisenberg, or whether it's Kenneth Branagh, or whether it's, John Cusack, always playing the Woody Allen character because he's too old to play it. None of these characters are like Woody Allen at all. But plus the female lead in this, Lou Delage, the woman who has the affair... She's great. She's not only she beautiful, she's great. I think she's terrific. So is the mother-in-law. Yes, this would be on my, unless it's in a remarkable year of movies at this point, this would certainly be on my top 10 list, although we're only in March.
All right, now is the Wilton Library going to escort you out with security?
Yes, they're about to do that. I'll tell you what I just did. I took my computer while I was listening to you guys. I took my computer. I put it back in my cubicle. I took the phone and the digicorder, and now I'm outside, and it's like 40 degrees.
You want to hear it?
You will not be silenced.
And I can't, and it's kind of cold, but I can handle it. No problem.
Good. Jeffrey and Bill, would you like to hear an interesting story about Woody Allen directed a movie completely in French? And when one watches the movie, it might strike you as like, does Woody Allen speak French fluently? Like, where did he learn how to speak French?
I don't think he did. I think he had a go-between that helped him.
No.
Facilitated.
He speaks French. And do you want to know who taught... Can I tell you who taught him how to speak French?
Is it going to be Mia?
My mother.
Who?
My late mother taught Woody Allen how to speak French. My mother is French. She's from Paris. And she taught at a very, very elite language place.
How long have I known you? And this is the first time I'm hearing this story.
Well, I'm telling you the story. I'm not making it up. She would go to Woody Allen's house, 4 or 5 times a week. It was an immersive situation to his apartment, and they would sit there for 6 hours and talk in French. The name of the language school was called Michelle Thomas Language Center. My mother taught Diana Ross. My mother taught Jean Marsh. My mother taught a lot of people, and she taught Woody Allen how to speak French, and that is absolutely 100%. I never told you the story before, but I'm telling it to you now.
In the words of the late Johnny Carson, I did not know that.
Well, now you did.
May I just interject something? I thought that
Please,
I was at
it's
least
your podcast.
I thought I was at least competent at some French expressions, and I could certainly read it. And I thought, well, I can muddle along, at least with storekeepers and bartenders and whatnot. When you get to Paris and you try out your French, it all collapses instantly because you can't, you can't understand the locals. They don't, you know, they're not speaking.
But they've gotten a little nicer over the years about not kicking you in the nuts and telling you to leave.
I never felt that snob thing from Parisians. Actually, they...
Really?
Yeah,
When I went to Paris with my mother, who's from Paris, I didn't talk at all. She talked, and she was treated, given the red carpet treatment because she, you know, nobody thought she was a foreigner. She was not.
Okay.
So I never, you know, I didn't, you don't, but I, as if you talk and they don't know, I don't know what, I haven't been in Paris in a number of years. I don't know if you go there now, if they treat you like, oh, shitty American kind of thing.
All you have to do is have the right attitude and don't talk like an American, don't act like an American. I was paid one of the greatest compliments of my life, which was back in the 70s. A guy said, you know, you don't act like an American. You don't even seem like an American, except for your language thing. And I thought, gee, that's wonderful. That's one of the best compliments I've ever received.
Yeah, it's a nice compliment.
Yeah, well, we're not that proud of you here in this country either. Hey, speaking of people in different places and your mom taking you to France, is anybody watching Expats, the Nicole Kidman thing from Lulu Wang?
I was kind of like hoping. I was thinking about avoiding that. Actually, do you think I should?
I cannot recommend the way Neil has so enthusiastically endorsed the last two things he's seen, and I really do want to see the Michael Keaton movie. I have to tell you that this—if you thought Rabbit Hole that she did about 12 years ago was an amuse-bouche to warm you up for how grief-stricken Expats and yet it's about two couples. Actually, one of them has lost a child the way she did in the original. She's married to an Asian guy, they're living in Hong Kong, and the child goes missing. It sounds dreadful, but it's very, very deftly handled. Lulu Wang, as I said, did won a Golden Globe for a movie a couple of years ago, the name of which escapes me, and
I know the film you're talking about. She's an excellent director. She's a very smart.
Yeah, this is on Amazon, I believe, and I really cannot recommend it more highly. As I said, I think it's six or eight episodes. Once I got into it, and it's like so many things streaming these days. And everybody you meet at a cocktail party goes, "You just have to get through the first two." But this falls into that category only because you are so depressed by it. Danny Houston is also in it as one of the guy in the other the other couple involved, and that's all I want to say about it.
Bill, they said it in around 14 when there were a lot of political demonstrations, a lot of political tumults.
Correct, and that is a backdrop.
Yeah,
yeah, you're right.
Did it have something to do with one of the children missing?
No, but it is an interesting, it overlaps a couple of the storylines, and it is an interesting sort of time and place.
I've had this impression of Hong Kong. I've never been there. I almost went there on one of my trips to Vietnam, but I've always had this impression that it's overbuilt. There's too many skyscrapers. The character of the city, which used to be something much more flavorful back in the middle of the 20th century, before there was a... Clark Gable film called Soldier of Fortune. I remember thinking, oh, that looks like an interesting town. But it doesn't seem interesting now. It seems kind of frosty and cold.
Well, without Googling it, I think it's 14 million people, which makes it, three times or two and a half times the size of Manhattan?
Yeah.
Well, let me recommend a movie that I think both of you will really like.
Yeah.
And it's a documentary, and it's called Remembering Gene Wilder.
I'd like to see that. I was thinking to myself, I want to see that for sure. Where did you see that? Where is it streaming?
What's it about?
It's a murder mystery with very spicy. No, it's a documentary, and it's a look back at the life and career of Gene Wilder, who personally has given me a lot of laughs over the year. over the years. And, you know, Wilder, first of all, co-starred in my all-time favorite comedy ever made, which is the original Producers, not the shitty remake with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane, with Zero Mostel. And that movie put him on the map and also earned him an Oscar nomination. And they have all these people that worked with Gene Wilder, like Mel Brooks is there talking about... First of all, I didn't know that Young Frankenstein, which Mel Brooks obviously wrote and directed, that it was co-written by Gene Wilder. I didn't know that. And not only was it co-written by Gene Wilder, Gene Wilder came up with the whole concept. He wrote a whole draft of it and said to Mel Brooks, I want you to direct this movie. And Mel Brooks goes, all right. And then they kind of worked on the draft and punched up the script together and worked on it together. But this whole idea, the whole Young Frankenstein movie, the genesis of it, the origin of it, came from Gene Wilder's brain, basically.
I have two thoughts. The two thoughts are, isn't it strange that Mel Brooks, when you think of his illustrious past and what he's known for primarily, are Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. Isn't it strange? Isn't it curious?
I think the Producers would be right up there.
And if you don't mind my saying.
Certainly not at the time it was released. Certainly not at the time it was released, but because of the hit Broadway show, I think it has a tremendous cult following.
Yeah.
You know, I've interviewed Brooks numerous times. I've actually dined with Mel Brooks, and it's his favorite movie of all his movies also. He's like number one. He goes, number one. Like was before the Broadway musical comes out. He was like, he thought that was his best movie.
I'm going to date myself and say The 2000-Year-Old Man was probably my first exposure to him. I don't even remember where or how, unless I was at a party as a kid and some adult put it on. But
you're talking about a comedy album that he and Carl Reiner recorded.
Most people's first introduction to Mel Brooks were those 2000-Year-Old Men comedy. But anyway, this is a Gene Wilder thing. And so Mel Brooks does talk about how he cast Wilder in the film and their process of working together and their many collaborations over the years. But, you know... Alan Alda, who's never done a movie, to my knowledge, with Gene Wilder, he's all over this documentary because apparently they were, like, really great friends. And he kind of, like, tells stories about Gene Wilder, like, offset, you know, like, in their friendship, which is kind of interesting. But there's lots of movie clips from Bonnie and Clyde. I don't know if you remember. He has a very short role in Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde pick him up on the road, and him and his girlfriend,
That's a great scene. That's an excellent scene. Remember the moment when she confesses her actual age and he looks at her with a kind of an odd, shocked look?
Yeah.
Well, what Arthur Penn says is when, you know, the script was given to him, he didn't find that there was no humor in that scene, and Gene Wilder made it really funny.
Yeah.
And they show that scene in this documentary, and Wilder is just very funny in the scene.
Yeah.
And then, you know, other stuff they talk about Willy Wonka, and another one of my favorites is in Woody Allen's Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, the sequence where Gene Wilder,
the doctor and his love affair with a sheep. Yeah, that's pretty good. Actually.
And they talk about how Gene Wilder had the ability to just take the craziest premise and just make it palatable and really funny. And
they're getting drunk on Woolite.
that says it all. And, you know, then there's the Richard Pryor stuff, like Silver Streak and Stir Crazy. And then they talk about his marriage to Gilda Radner, who sadly died of ovarian cancer. That's touched upon. But if you're a fan of Gene Wilder, I say, really, check out this documentary. It's not only clips from all his movies and really funny clips from his movies, but a lot of inside information from people that worked with him.
Well, we can't mention this without also saying that dropping this week from a prominent director is a two-parter on... Steve Martin's career, which I haven't seen yet, but I hear also great things about.
You know, I ask you guys, and you don't answer me. I'd like you to answer me, please. Where does the Wilder doc streaming as we speak?
And... Oh, sorry, I have no idea.
Okay.
I'm going to look it up for you right now.
Okay. What about and the Martin thing, come out yet? Because I haven't noticed
it. The Martin thing is on Apple, I think, this week.
Okay. Starting this week, okay.
Okay. The Gene Wilder thing is online, and it's on 45 different services. You pay $4.99. It's on Netflix. It's on Hulu. It's on Prime Video.
Cool.
You just
okay.
go there and pay your $4.99 or whatever, and you can watch it. And that,
and while you're the show historian, can you also look up where the Steve Martin doc is dropping? Because I'm pretty sure it's on
sure.
Apple, but I don't
want
to.
What is the name? Where is the name?
It's
what is
Steve
the name
Martin
of the
in two? It, I think it's called Steve Martin in Two Pieces.
Oh yeah, here we go. Okay, that is on. All right.
Jeffrey, see how smoothly this goes?
Yeah, it does. I know.
Apple TV Plus.
I'm stunned I was right.
So what I was trying
listen,
to...
this was fun, guys. I really appreciate it.
So what I was trying to say earlier, and Neil cut me off and didn't allow me to make the point, which is that Mel Brooks' two biggest movies... are, you know, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. They both came out in 74, the same year. It's amazing. But that's how it rolled
really?
Out. And there was no year before or since in which he made that kind of impact and got as many people excited about his stuff as that one year. So that was really something when you think about it.
How did he do that in one year?
Good question.
Well, they were made at different times and they were just released at the same time. Probably the studios thought that was a good idea.
I don't even know which one came out first or which one was made first, but they, if you look them up, they're both 1974 films. So.
Well, in the documentary, I could tell you the answer to that. Blazing Saddles definitely came out first.
Okay.
And after they collaborated, Gene Wilder then went back, since they parodied Westerns.
Right.
Gene Wilder said, why don't we parody, I want to parody horror movies. And they also tell you in the documentary that, you know the scene when putting on the Ritz, when Peter Boyle,
yeah.
Gene Wilder dancing?
Excellent scene, yeah.
That's Gene Wilder's idea, and Mel Brooks fought him like vehemently. Not he goes, no, we can't do this. It's a complete disgrace to James Whale, who is the director of the original Frankenstein. That we cannot do that. And Gene Wilder was like, no, we have to do this. And this went on for like weeks and weeks. And Gene Wilder kept lobbying for this. And Mel Brooks goes, I am not doing this. It completely takes you out of the film. And Gene Wilder goes. Then Gene Wilder said, well, I don't know, watch the, I don't want to give it away, but how it got into the movie, and then Mel Brooks apologizes to Gene Wilder and goes, it's the best scene in the whole movie. It's really, I'm telling you, like the documentary, check it out. It's
I'm
like a lot
definitely
of
definitely watching it.
A lot of backstory stuff, you know, so.
I'd like to move on to a film that I saw last May when it was called Black Flies. It's now called Not Asphalt, I can't remember what it's called. But it has the word asphalt in it. I think I'm right about that. And it's basically Sean Penn and... now I'm blanking on... Oh, Grace. I just love when I have these moments when I go up. Anyway, I thought, if you have seen... I know you guys have seen the Martin Scorsese film from 99 called Bringing Out the Dead, which is about...
Oh, yeah. I'm dying to see this. And the other person in it is blanking, too. Yeah. I like Bringing Out the Dead. I know, a movie called Asphalt City.
Asphalt City. Great. Okay. See, that's not
and
a very good
Sean
title,
Penn,
actually.
And Ty Sheridan is in it, and
Ty Sheridan.
Mike Tyson's in it.
And it Mike should Tyson. Be acknowledged that it is not just something that was dreamt up by a screenwriter looking to have a high-impact experience. It was based upon a recollection, a book that the guy who wrote it, who actually was an EMT. So it's a collection of some horrific and very strong and very jarring experiences that he went through doing that job. And so basically they just strung them all together, and I thought it was interesting when I was watching it in Cannes at the Salle Debussy.
That's where it premiered, right? Didn't it premiere
yes,
there?
Yes, that's where I saw it first, and they had the whole thing. I mean, Terry Fromeau thought it was excellent, and they had the press conference, and I remember saying to Manola Dargis in a line that I thought, you know, if you liked and had a place in your head for the Scorsese, which is, was never that thrilled by the Scorsese. I thought it was okay. But it was...
Yeah, I like them. We've had this conversation before. I like that movie a lot more than you did. But I do want to see this one.
What? Are you talking about Kills of the Flower Moon?
No, he's talking about Bringing Out the Dead.
Oh, Bringing Out the Dead.
Yeah.
Has Asphalt City been released yet in this country?
Next week.
It's playing with Michael Keaton's movie and Coup de Chance. Okay,
now that's significant, Neil, that you haven't, you don't know it, and you haven't been offered a chance to see it, or what's the deal?
No, I know about the movie, but I didn't know if it was released yet or when it was getting a release date.
Okay.
But would you recommend it?
I do. It's a rough sit because it's not. I think basically it's the hip critics, including Manola Dargis, who thought it was ridiculous. She called it shit to me, basically, and I can't understand why she would say that, because again, it's based upon things that actually happened with this guy who wrote a book about it. But it's not. The word went around to all the cool kids in Cannes that this is not something you want to get behind, because the depictions of trauma and agony and all kinds of ugly, unsavory things amongst people, amongst non-white people. Let's put, you know, lower
some
income people.
I was
people.
Just going to say, some
Jeffrey,
of which we...
Let me ask you, is it mainly
racist?
About the paramedics, or is it mainly about the people that the paramedics are treating in their backs?
There's
their
three
story?
Paramedics that we stay with, Ty Sheridan, Sean Penn, and let's see, who else? Somebody plays the head of the operation. Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson is in it. But basically, it's these three guys and their experience going from one horrific encounter with people of a, you know, kind of a difficult living experiences in crummy buildings in Brooklyn, mostly. And it's not pleasant. It's not pleasant. And I'll tell you, when I was watching it at the Bercy, about three or four women that I noticed, including one sitting right next to me, got up and left. After about maybe 20 minutes,
really?
25 minutes. Yeah. And I thought, okay,
wow.
Well, they didn't, it's not to their liking, fine. But I thought it was significant
from
that they
the
were.
From the racism or from the violence?
A combination. They just thought it was too much. It wasn't that horrible. I mean, listen, this is, they don't call EMTs when everything is fine and they and people just want to talk about their lives or want to know what kind of medication. They call them when there's something horrible happening and they needs immediate assistance. So that's what the job is and that's what the topic is. Same thing with bringing out the dead. So I don't understand why people were so dismissive of it and just didn't want to talk about it. But it's a very decent film of this type. If you have a way of watching this and saying, "Okay, well, this is what the life is. This is what it is." So I thought
well,
it was.
I'll tell you what to avoid.
Yeah.
Not that you're going to go see this.
Yeah.
But since we were talking about dementia films with Michael Keaton, Knox Goes Away, there's another dementia film with starring Russell Crowe called Sleeping Dogs.
Okay.
Which is a dog. It's a dog. Just don't even.
Don't even think about it.
Everybody hated it on our show. And
okay.
And the other thing I don't recommend, which is the perfect title, which describes the movie, it's a movie called Lousy Carter. And it is lousy. And it's with, and you probably both know this actor, David Krumholtz. He was in Leopoldstadt on Broadway.
Yeah.
And he's very good. He's very good. And he's even good in this, but... He's completely defeated by the direction and the writing. There's not one likable character in this entire movie. I mean,
what's the log line?
He's given 6 months to live, and you're actually rooting for the guy to die. That's how much he's you're not like the protagonist in the movie. So he's perfect.
Okay, we'll avoid that. Since I mentioned Ben Gazzara during Roadhouse at the top of this, I have to finish or come to the near conclusion of this by saying there was a famous television show when I was growing up called Run for Your Life.
Sure.
And the problem with Run for Your Life was in the opening credits, they said, he has 1, maybe 2 years to live. And so by the fifth year, people were going, this is bullshit. This guy was supposed to die 3 years ago. So they didn't know it was going to be a huge hit, and then it was, and then they couldn't really sort of backpedal.
So what was the granddaddy movie that started this whole idea of, like, you've only got a few hours, a few days, maybe a few weeks to live, and you've got to accomplish something and until the big moment happens? That would be DOA, correct?
I was just going to say the DOA.
Yeah.
From the, I knew it was a 50s kind of black and white.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And try to figure out who that was. What's his name?
Edmund O'Brien.
Edmund O'Brien. Right.
Is that the film you're thinking about, Jeffrey? DOA.
Yes, that's what I was thinking about. DOA is the
father. And then they made
a
remake of that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And Dennis Quaid, right?
Dennis Quaid.
Yeah. So, let's just finish off with a little thing I'd like to introduce, which is an idea about a kind of a an aspect of the Misfits called Revival House. And the idea is to talk about the virtues of a film that is basically not on anyone's radar if you're, say, under 50 or under 45. Because most millennials regard the 80s as ancient history. They don't even want to know about almost anything that was made before the 80s. And,
wow.
And Zoomers, forget it. I don't think that they really think much before the turn of the century, maybe 95
or something. Is that what they call Gen Z people now, Zoomers? That's the first time I'm hearing that. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
By the way, Revival House is brought to you by the Wilton Public Library, an established library in Wilton, Connecticut.
So you go first, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
I thought I would either talk about one of two films one that's not too old, and that's called Vanilla Sky, which I just happened to do a little riff about, and it's
the Spanish one or the American remake.
The American remake, particularly because that's the film I saw. Abre los ojos, which is actually fascinating. It's very well made, and it's there's no question that you're watching a quality film. And same thing about Cameron Crowe's version, which is quite striking. I mean, it's really a stretch for him, and clearly a stretch for Tom Cruise, who of course has stopped doing all character-related characters. I mean, he doesn't do anything about the interior of his characters. He's basically, you know, the Energizer Bunny these days, and he's been doing this for like 10, 15 years.
That's the truth, and you can't handle the truth.
I can't handle it. That's right. It's too much for me. But I can't... But I really was so bummed out by that movie because it's really about a guy going through a horrible nightmare. He's a shitty person, and he's kind of selfish, and it's really not a pleasant thing to sit through. And I was kind of watching it the first time I saw it, and I was very much in the Cameron Crowe camp. I was a huge fan of Almost Famous, and I loved Jerry Maguire, and I thought, gee, you know, he's a good human being. I know him personally, and I have a relationship with him for like 25 years now. And I didn't know what to do with it, except that it made me feel awful. It made me feel so badly about everything. I thought maybe...
Well, he had a lot of money, and there was a big expectation of him, and it was like the Friedkin fail with Sorcerer, but I think that movie opens like gangbusters. The Times Square scene and the dreams and everything, it's just, it starts out... like it's going to be one of the best movies you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then as soon as Cruise puts a mask on, he doesn't want to be in the movie anymore.
That's right. It actually started out by making $28 million its first weekend, which by the standard of...
Penelope is in both versions, right? She's in both versions.
That's correct. She is.
Yeah.
Yep. So I thought
that's a good Jeopardy question.
That's what you're recommending?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying it because I just happened to write about it an hour ago, and I was just on the top of my mind. What I wanted to discuss, which I don't think any Zoomers or Gen Xers have seen, and that's HUD, the Martin Ritt film.
Oh, Paul Newman. That's a great movie.
And that's a legendary film in that it's so cleanly put together, and the cinematography by James Wong Howe is among the most elegant uses of black and white 2.39:1 CinemaScope framing. It's really a beautiful film. Melvin Douglas is magnificent. He won, I think, for, was it a Best Actor?
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Great movie.
And poor
Brandon. Great movie.
Poor Brandon DeWilda, who didn't last very long after this, but he was, of course, the little kid in Shane back in '53. And
really?
Yeah.
And Patricia
he's
Neal.
He's come back, Shane. He's come back, Shane. That's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kid who's outside of the
That's
and it's a really good, well-written character, and it's Paul Newman. Of course, the whole thing with Paul Newman's character is that they intended this movie to be a portrait of a really shitty human being, a selfish, acrid, a barbed wire soul, you know, not a good fellow at all, not even half good. And what happened is that he was so cool-looking, and he had this kind of aloof vibe about him that most of the younger people who saw that film, but when it first came out, thought he was really pretty amazing. They thought it was. They went back to see it, and he became a thing because he was a creep and a bad person, but he was a cool bad person. And that
so
was,
is that the birth? Is that the birth of the anti-hero?
Yeah, kind of the thing. And Martin Ritt himself actually said, "You know, I started to realize that that was the beginning of the '60s, 63, this film, because it was...
I'm going to throw a trivia question out to both of you. Okay?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Having interviewed Paul Newman...
When?
What year did
you talk to him?
It was right... What was that movie where he was like...
With Linda Fiorentino. We both interviewed him, that junket.
He was pretending to be in a coma.
Right.
Or something like that.
Something about the money. Not take the money and run, but something about the money.
Okay.
Well, anyway, what is Paul... Out of the entire catalog of Paul Newman's films...
Yeah.
What is Paul Newman's favorite film of all his films?
Of all his films. The
film.
Silver Chalice.
What is Paul Newman's...
Silver Chalice is the joke answer. But... It would have to be something with Joanne Woodward.
Yeah, maybe the one he directed, Rachel, which is a very decent character-driven film.
I can give
film.
You 10 guesses. I don't think you'd get it. But
Mr. and Mrs. Fields?
Nope.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of his caper movies. I don't think it's one of the Ross McDonald
movies.
None
of the soapy stuff like On the Terrace or the Young Philadelphians.
From the Terrace, yeah.
Nope. But it's not Butch Cassidy or the
Sting. We're flipping over all the cards.
Or,
and it's not the Outrage, the remake.
Not Cool Hand Luke. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
His favorite movie is Slapshot.
What?
Oh, yeah. I have heard him say that, or you've told that story before.
His favorite movie is Slapshot. Replay.
Wow.
Like a minor.
Probably because he got to drink beer every day.
A minor league hockey player who gets into fights, and they're the Hanson brothers, and it's very funny. And, he loves that movie. That's his favorite movie.
I have it on Blu-ray, and I love it as well, and I've seen it about 8 or 9 times. I really think that movie is, it really feels, it was shot in a kind of a blue-collar town in Pennsylvania somewhere
that?
Or something.
Robert did Benton anybody directed know? It, didn't he?
Who did? Arthur Penn?
Robert Benton.
Oh, Robert Benton, that sounds pop. The Kramer versus Kramer guy, yeah.
Is that, I think awesome. I'm right about that, am I right?
No, the director...
you look it up, you've been...
The director of Slapshot was George Roy Hill, who also directed.
Oh, George Roy Hill.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
So he was reunited with him.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Listen, I don't really understand this revival category, but I will tell you that, speaking of Paul Newman, I think, and this is going to be controversial, but I love that, I think The Hustler is better than The Color of Money, like by a long shot.
Absolutely. Yep.
Is that?
No
okay,
question about
I didn't
it.
Expect you guys to agree.
No, it's a magnificent looking film also. Talk about wonderful, luscious black and white. But it's the only thing that's a little bizarre about it is that I don't understand why George C. Scott, who's just a businessman, he's just a gambler, he's not some evil guy with horns on his head and a sharp, pointed tail. He's just the world's full of them. You know, people like that are basically out for the money, and they're selfish and they're shrewd. So he wasn't in a horrible person. But Piper Laurie, who plays the girlfriend of Paul Newman, is very. She hates him almost immediately. She'd say he's kind of sucking the life out of Paul Newman's soul,
I think that was the intention of the writer and the director. And if you see him as a nicer guy than that, I think he gets off on the juice of being in charge of people that can do things he can't do. And there are a lot of people like that.
Yeah. And he's good at reading people as to how good they are and whether they're going to go the distance.
I apologize. You guys cut out for a minute. I'm assuming you're talking about The Hustler because
that's right.
you actually
yeah.
it was
yeah.
okay.
Yeah.
You know, what's sad is that I don't really care for The Color of Money. Which is the Martin Scorsese sequel to that.
Well, you must have cut out when I said, because I said, I think it's not nearly as good as The Hustler. And I thought you guys would argue with me over that, and I was wrong.
No, it's not. And that's the one that he wins the Oscar for. But, you know, that's the kind of Lifetime Achievement Oscar. That's like, well,
that's right.
I guess we, you know...
That was a
That's
gimme.
That it was.
Yeah, I should have won for The Verdict. I should have won for other things.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
The Verdict is brilliant. Sidney Lumet. And that is just... I just saw that the other day again. It was on, like, TCM or something.
Yeah.
What a great... It filmed at Captain Astoria Studios.
Did you see Bruce Willis in the gallery?
Yep. I've done a thing about that, actually.
He's an extra. Wait, have you seen that, Neil?
No.
Many times as you've seen The Verdict, on the last day they're in court... When the jury comes back and says, can we actually give them more money? And, like, everybody's like, there's a shot of, because Lamette specifically takes long shots of Newman in that movie and lets the close-up happen at that decision when he's really got his life back. There is no other case. This is the case. And that's the moment when he realizes it is the case.
Yeah.
Right behind him over his shoulder is Bruce Willis with hair.
Actually, you can see Willis during Paul Newman's entire sum-up argument, his soliloquy at the very end.
What's your favorite courtroom sum-up argument in any movie ever made?
I don't know.
Because I got one.
Orson Welles and Compulsion?
That will be my recommendation.
Orson Welles and Compulsion is good.
Maximilian Schell and Judgment at Nuremberg.
I like Frederick March and Spencer Tracy in the Scope.
Inherit the Wind.
Inherit the Wind.
Yeah. Well, the one that I and you want me to recommend like a movie that Zoomers should see or something like that. To me, it's the greatest closing argument. And it's a Norman Jewison film starring Al Pacino, and it is And Justice for All.
Is that when he loses his temper and goes over the top?
You're out of order. No, it's too much Pacino. That movie is too much hoo-ha Pacino.
Yeah.
And it's Jack Warden is in it playing the suicidal judge. What a fucking crazy movie. I love this movie. So if you want
John Forsythe is the guy that's on trial. I don't agree with that.
It's from late 70s, 79, I think. And it's, I'd say you want to see something fun. I mean, that's just wacky, crazy movie.
Yeah.
It's really good. And I love
Watch The Gentleman with Theo James and Vinnie Jones and Ray Winstone. It's directed and created by Guy Ritchie. By the way, to do a callback, the reason that Bring Out the Dead didn't do well was because it wasn't what audiences expected from a Scorsese film at the time. I love what we've done here today, and I want to thank you for inviting me. I want to also say that if you want to hear people cut Neil Rosen off more often, we have a podcast we do every week called Sitting Around Talking Movies, wherever you listen to podcasts.
All podcast platforms. If you want to watch a great television show, it's broadcast on PBS nationally, but you can see it on YouTube. Just put in Talking Pictures with Neil Rosen. Don't just put in Talking Pictures, because there are actually other shows named Talking Pictures. But if you put in Talking Pictures with Neil Rosen, you can they all come up. You can see our whole panel. It's a roundtable discussion where we talk about Poor Things and Maestro and Killers of the Flower Moon and anything else that you want to, you know.
That's good.
Anything else that you want to hear about.
I'm a fan,
Jeff,
Neil.
When you post this, Jeff, and all the comments say we hijacked the podcast today, we absolutely did.
Well, listen. Both of you said,
and we want to thank the Wilton, Connecticut Public Library.
I love that moment, didn't you? When she actually knocked on the door and said,
"We thought you were getting a phone call." Neil and I sort of broke off into a separate discussion group.
Oh, by the way, do you hear the train in the background? Do you hear it right now?
No, we didn't hear the train. No.
Anyway, the reason that I brought up that I suggested the idea of Revival House is because a lot of passion and a lot of love came out from all three of us when we started talking about these films, and there's a lot of cynicism in assessments of most of the films today, because many films are regarded as basically product. They're just, you know, they're streaming product that you kind of sit there and half watch while you're flipping through your phone pages. You know, it's like this is a whole different era we're in. We're not in a great
period. Well, since you brought it up, then to put a nice button on this, if you want to keep recording, I'll ask all of you, and I'll start. I think the new Roadhouse is better than the original.
I agree.
And I know there's going to be a lot of people that disagree. What do you got?
I agree.
So there we are. That's the three of us. So I have.
That's controversy.
Anyway, I didn't know where this is going to go, but I swear the spigot was turned on when I started talking about some of the films that Zoomers and Millennials don't even care about. And I'm sorry, but this is we're not living in a golden age of cinema. We're just not. I wish we were, of course, but we're not. And it feels nice to kind of.
I'll leave you on this note.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a comedy movie released in theaters like. Big budget comedy, they all go straight to streaming.
Yeah.
And I just read yesterday that Judd Apatow, and I agree with him 100%, says that it's going to change. All it's going to take is one movie like The Hangover or something. So it's going to be released in theaters. It's going to make like $1 billion or something. And then these cheap executives, they go, oh, people want to see this. And then they'll start making tons of comedies. All it takes is one comedy that's going to make a lot of money.
Well, he's certainly the guy that could do it.
But I agree with him. I think that these executives just follow the money. This made money. Let's do something like that. And then you'll just see a whole slate of comedy films.
Now, why are comedies not as good and not as popular? Because people are afraid to laugh at 80% of the things out there because they don't want to get in trouble from the woke people.
Well, that's just sad. That's just very sad.
I mean, that's just the culture as we speak. But
that's why if you don't want to be woke, you go back in time. You do the holdovers, you set it in a period when you can say or do anything you want.
That's exactly. True, that's true.
Right.
That's true.
Hey, listen, I just want to mention that, see, you were wrong, Jeff, about Neil. I thought he was great. I thought he did really great.
Neil, you're a very easy guy to talk to, and you know a lot, and I really think it was great that you came on and chatted on the mission.
Well, thank you, but I thought Neil was good, too.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jeffrey. Anytime, right. It's my pleasure. Okay. And maybe come on our podcast again. You've done it in the past, a little quid pro quo. You know?
Sure, man.
We don't get kicked out of wherever we do it.
That's right.
And we do it on Zoom. We're all in the comfort of our homes.
I was going to do it on Zoom today, but
have a good evening.
Anyway, take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Jeffrey. Have a great evening.
Good night,
Neil.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.